Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of whether Mitt Romney will be slowed or sullied in New Hampshire as Ron Paul makes gains on Romney's substantial lead. Michael Lind, who has an article at Salon.com, Race, Liberty, and Ron Paul, joins us. Then we will look into strikes in oil-rich Nigeria over the removal of gas subsidies that have more than doubled the price of gasoline. Omoyele Sowore, a Nigerian human rights and pro-democracy campaigner who is the founder and publisher of SaharaReporters.com, joins us to discuss the role of Shell Oil, the IMF, and rampant corruption in the Nigerian government at a time when the president, Goodluck Jonathan, has declared a state of an emergency in the government's conflict with the Islamist militia Boko Haram. Then, finally, Tom Ferguson joins us. He has an article at Alternet, The Devil and Rick Santorum, Dilemmas of a Wholly Owned Subsidiary, that's H-O-L-Y, that makes the case that while Republican policies are stunningly oriented towards making the richest Americans richer, they have spent decades cultivating ordinary voters to focus on social wedge issues rather than economic policies that are and are thus missing an opportunity in 2012 since the Democrats are vulnerable on the economy. Joining us now is Michael Lind, who is the Whitehead Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation. He's the author of a number of books, including Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, and What Lincoln Believed. His book, The American Way of Strategy, U.S. Foreign Policy and the American Way of Life, was critically hailed as a groundbreaking study of America's relationship with the world. Mr. Lind has been an editor or staff writer for The New Yorker, Harper's Magazine, and The New Republic. He has an article at Salon.com, Race, Liberty, and Ron Paul. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Well, thank you for having me, Ian.
And Ron Paul is making some inroads into the substantial lead that Romney has in New Hampshire and also in South Carolina. He's coming in second, according to the polls. Do you think it's going to make any difference? This is beginning to feel pretty much like an inevitability that Romney will quickly sew up the nomination.
Well, Newt Gingrich pointed out that because of the proportional representation rules in terms of the voting, that is, it's not winner-take-all in a lot of the primaries, it might be more difficult for Romney to sew everything up until a latter date. But so far, it appears that the conservatives are splitting their vote among multiple candidates the way they did in 2008. And that, of course, allowed a moderate Republican, John McCain, or at least relatively moderate by the standards of his party, to win the nomination.
So what explains the fact that the conservative vote is dispersed? The Southern evangelicals, there's some of their powerhouses, Gary Bauer, the Reverend Dobson, and Don Wildman, apparently meeting in Texas trying to come up with an alternative to what they have. Ironically, the two kind of Christian conservatives are both Catholics. Does that matter much to that vote?
Well, I think what you're seeing is, as I wrote in the Salon a year or so ago, that the right has now become a counterculture. In the same way as the radical left, the hippie and yippie left of the 1960s, was not interested in changing society but simply wanted to reject it or secede from it, I think you're seeing the same kind of mentality on the right now. And what is typical of countercultures, at least when they're in politics, is that they continually devour themselves because no leader is pure enough for the faithful. And what you saw on the radical left in the 1960s was just one schism after another as the movement fissioned along ideological lines into smaller and smaller sectarian groups. And I think you're seeing this here. It kind of reminds me in a way of the German Green Party in the 1990s, because the Greens were a young party, and they were divided between what was the two wings of the Realos, that is the realists, and the Fundis, the fundamentalists. And I think you see sort of a Realo-Fundi divide now in the American right.
Well, but hasn't it always been assumed, Michael Lind, that conservatives in this country are much more pragmatic than liberals, who tend to be quite self-righteous and easily disappointed, whereas Republicans seem to be able to swallow it? And after all, it does seem that in many ways the way that the Republican presidential system works is that the person who's been in there the longest and has paid the most dues wins it, like McCain, like Bob Dole, and like Romney. There's an assumption that they'll get over their ideological differences and get behind their candidates because they have such a deep hatred for Obama.
Well, I think those generalizations were true of the Republicans of the Eisenhower and Nixon era, and maybe even of the Bob Dole era. But right now, what has happened is, as a result of this long-term transformation of the party system, the base of the Republican Party is the white South, the white Protestant evangelical South. And so this is a radically different political culture from that of the old Northeastern and Midwestern local businessmen and JCs, you know, and bankers who used to be the core of the Republican Party. These are the great-great-grandchildren of the Confederates, who tried to destroy the country rather than compromise. And then they used the filibuster decade after decade to block civil rights. So in my view, and I'm a white Southerner myself, you know, this is all very clear. If you look at everything from trying to shut down the government, you know, to the claim that a fairly center-right Democrat is a radical, you know, trying to destroy the nation, this comes straight out of what used to be the right wing of the Southern Democrats. It is not coming out of the playbook of the older moderate Republicans, including Mitt Romney's father, the governor of Michigan, who was a classic moderate Republican of the Rockefeller School. This is more Strom Thurmond, Dixiecrat mentality.
So, Michael Lind, why don't they have a candidate then? If they dominate the party, I guess the closest Southerner they have would be Newt Gingrich.
Well, their natural candidate really should have been Rick Perry, and he just failed. He just does not have the personal characteristics and possibly the skills to unite this coalition. But you know, he's an evangelical Protestant. He was a military cadet at Texas A&M. He served in the military, Texas governor. You know, on paper he looked like their candidate. Mm-hmm. But he just flubbed it. And I can say, as a native Texan, one of the reasons some of these Texas governors like Perry and also Bush, who was elected, George W. Bush, you know, tend to surprise people with their ineptitude at the national level, is the fact that the Texas governor has very little power. It's largely a symbolic position. The lieutenant governor really runs the state. It's a quasi-parliamentary system. So the fact that you've been Texas governor really doesn't mean you've ever done anything other than meet with Girl Scouts, you know, and issue proclamations.
So can they do anything, given that their best hope was Perry and he just basically fizzled, and Gingrich is a little quirky, I suppose, and damaged goods? What are they going to do? Are they going to get surly and stay home? Or are they going to back Santorum? Or what, is there any role for them apart from being spoilers?
Well, I wouldn't rule any of these second and third tier candidates out, including Perry and Gingrich, because once this moves into the deep South, into South Carolina, then who knows? You know, you may have some of the conservatives drop out, and they may rally behind one. It's possible that this will repeat the script of 2008, in which the conservatives divided their vote, allowing the moderate to win. But it's not certain. This is a crazy year, and this is a party that increasingly is apocalyptic and countercultural in its view of things. You know, and in some ways, this is like 1964. When Barry Goldwater, essentially, the conservatives knew he couldn't be elected, but they didn't care.
Right.
It was expressive politics.
But surely the fact that that Romney's ahead in the polls in South Carolina indicates that, I mean, if you believe polls, and, you know, obviously you take a chance on them, but they've been largely correct so far. So where's the evidence then in South Carolina that
well, the only poll that counts is the actual vote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we'll see. But I wouldn't just take polls in all these primary states and then say it's all over. As somebody pointed out, some incredibly negligible people so far has voted in the Republican presidential primaries. You'd point 0.0001 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a bit early to declare that it's over. My money would be on Romney.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Lind, who's the Whitehead Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation and the author of a number of books, including Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. He has an article at Salon.com, Race, Liberty, and Ron Paul. Now, when you say in your article that Ron Paul displays moral idiocy by drawing a line from the Civil Rights Act directly to the Patriot Act, blaming all of that America's path towards this police state on the Civil Rights Act of 1964, to some extent he was challenged in that first debate up in New Hampshire by the questions of racist ramblings in his newsletter. But he defended himself in a way that that I frankly found interesting, that in this sort of constipated and sterile political arena that we have in the United States where serious issues are never discussed, this man brought up some pretty serious issues about how disproportionately whites use drugs, but blacks goes to prison for them, and how the poor blacks are the ones that get hauled into the military and sent off on these useless losing wars, etc. And to me, that was kind of worth the price of entry.
Well, the man is a master rhetorician, but the fact is there are a lot of people with a sincere concern about the fate of black Americans who do not then say, oh, but it's a terribly tyrannical to require stores to serve black patrons, right? And that is what he has said repeatedly, as well as his son, you know, saying that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and equivalent legislation was wrong, that to this day, if a store wanted to say colored's not allowed, that it would be better to allow that to happen legally, because it would be tyrannical to tell the store owner, you must serve people of all races. Right.
Well, that's true. That's kind of a wacky theory. But what he actually said in his defense was a really shameful reality in America, that whites don't tend to go to jail for drug use when they're the majority of drug users, whereas blacks do. The prisons are full of disproportionately with young black men. And he brought that up. I thought that was worth bringing up. Of course, there was no discussion of it.
That's because you're a progressive, and progressives resonate with his opposition to endless foreign wars and with a lot of this moral libertarianism and civil libertarianism. But I'm just saying that there's this other half, and you can't have one half of Ron Paul libertarianism without the other half. And there is a reason why he is running in the Republican primary rather than the Democratic primary. And there's a reason why these right-wing white backlash voters vote for him, as well as these other backlash candidates who more or less explicitly play on racism, like Rick Santorum saying the other day that black people should not live off of money given to them by other people. And
Gingrich, by the way, is associating food stamps with black Americans, when in fact the majority of users of food stamps are white Americans.
Yeah, no, it is not the case that all conservatives are racist, or that you can just reduce conservatism or libertarianism to racism. But I would like to make one basic point. You can't get off the hook by saying that, well, I like black people, but on the other hand, I think it would be tyrannical to prevent the store owner from calling the police to drag away the unwanted colored shopper. That just doesn't work, right? You know, so that racism comes in different varieties. There's a kind of racism which consists of active malevolence, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the Ku Klux Klan, you know, it's the segregationists. There's also a kind of racism and anti-Semitism, too, for that matter, or homophobia, that comes from indifference, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want you would never drag Jews away, you know, to the concentration camps, but on the other hand, you know, you're not going to intervene to stop it, or you don't really care, or you're weighing the good and the bad. And my own view, and this is just my view as a white Southerner born into what was still a segregated society, this was a dodge used by a lot of people who were moderately racist. I mean, they weren't malevolently racist. But the fact is, if you think there are two sides to the question of whether black people should be arrested, you know, for dining at white-only restaurants, then in my book, you're a racist. I don't care if you have black friends. I don't care if you care about blacks being disproportionately in prison. That's not an issue on which there are two sides.
Sure.
For a civilized person.
No, I certainly wouldn't want to be in a position of having to defend Ron Paul. But it seems that there's still a possibility. It's true that he's running as a Republican. His son was elected as a Republican. But they're constantly being asked, and they were just on Fox News, asked whether or not if he doesn't do well or doesn't win, which is not likely given Romney's surge, that he will run as a libertarian and as a spoiler. Do you think that's a possibility?
It's possible, you know, like Ralph Nader. And I think that the present political environment in all of the democratic countries in Europe as well as here, essentially what we're seeing is not a new political movement, either the right or the left. It's anti-political movements. It's anti-system movements. So, for example, in Germany, which is a very conservative, prudent country, they've elected representatives from the Pirate Party, which is a protest party. And if that sort of thing might happen in, I don't know, the Mediterranean countries, mm-hmm. but if the Germans are so unnerved by this continuing global crisis, then, of course, all kinds of crazy things are going to happen in other countries. So I think we're in a period of turmoil. And also I think that means that no matter who wins this year, everyone will be announcing after November 5th that there's now a new Republican era, there's now a new Democratic era, or something like that. I think we're in a period of flux where people are just angry and will be angry, you know, as long as the mass unemployment and the slow economy persist. And they'll just take out their anger every couple of years the only way they can, which is at the voting booth. But it means that it's going to be very difficult to establish working majorities in Congress, and it's going to be very difficult to carry out any kind of systematic program of reform in this turbulent atmosphere.
But just in closing, Michael Lind, why do you think then in this angry electorate, with this angry electorate, with the shrinking middle class globally because of globalism and a lot of unemployment, a lot of uncertainty, why would the American voters vote for the representative of the 1%, the oligarchical candidate?
Well, the only explanation I can come up with is, as I said, most people, unlike your listeners, derive their information very scantily from TV ads and radio ads and, you know, the occasional Rush Limbaugh show. And the fact is that if they're not paying attention and the only thing they know about Newt Gingrich, say, is that according to the Romney ad, you know, he was on the Fannie Mae payroll, that's all they know about him, then the Romney ad effectively destroyed that rival, right? And then you're blitzed with a lot of pro-Romney ads. Now, in the past, I was always skeptical of people who I thought overstressed the importance of campaign donations and so on. But in this new post-Citizens United environment, I don't know what other explanation there is. And we see this again, it's not unique to the United States. You know, Berlusconi until recently was prime minister of Italy. And he was just a media tycoon, right? I mean, it's as though, of course we have Bloomberg, right, as mayor of New York. Mm-hmm. And there are even noises about Bloomberg running for president. So I think we're in this new world where basically those who control the media and those who can raise money to manipulate it, can become not only kingmakers, but kings themselves.
So it's the democratic game show democracy.
Yeah, I think the parties as organizations are more or less extinct. And this is true even in Congress and in the Senate. The parties are basically dead. You have the candidate, and then you have the candidate's donors, who may be special interest groups, or they may be rich individuals, or in some cases you have self-finance candidates. And then you have the media people who tell you how to target this particular niche audience that you need. And then, you know, you go through the indignity of meeting these people at Howard Johnson's every 2 years if you're a congressman, or every 4 years if you're running for president. But after that, you know, you basically are a free agent. And it means you're free from the structure of an organized political party. And I think you see this happening in Europe as well as America. That is, it's just something about the nature of a suburbanized TV-watching population, that the kinds of political parties like the Democrats and Republicans used to be in the U.S. and Labor and Conservatives used to be in Britain, where you had the local precinct group, and then you had the state, and then you had the national, and it was all this kind of hierarchical club, and ordinary people took part. I think that's collapsed. Instead, you have just free-floating, largely ignorant voters. I mean, they're ignorant of politics. They're not ignorant of other things. And they're being manipulated by targeted, largely TV and radio campaigns,
which are making the media moguls even richer. So I thank
well, that's
you for
right. even if you no matter who wins,
they win.
They win. Yeah.
So, well, I thank you for joining us, Michael Lynn.
Well, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Lynn, the Whitehead Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation, the author of Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, What Lincoln Believed, and The American Way of Strategy, U.S. Foreign Policy, and the American Way of Life. He's been an editor and a staff writer for The New Yorker, Harper's Magazine, and The New Republic, and has an article at Salon.com, Race, Liberty, and Ron Paul. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the strikes over gas subsidies being removed in Nigeria.
Black and green instead of gang bandanas. FBI spying on us through the radio antennas. And I'm hitting cameras in the streetlight watching society. With no respect for the people's right to privacy. I wanna be free to live, able to have what I need to live. Bring the power back to the street where the people live. We sick of working for crumbs and filling up the prisons. Dying over money and relying on religion for help. Hey, can you relate? We living in a
no more bondage, no more political monsters, no more secrets.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Anide Akuru, who is the Executive Director of Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anide Akuru.
Thank you.
Tell me, what is your understanding of the general strikes that are going on that have essentially brought Nigeria to a standstill over the doubling of the price of gasoline because of the removal of gas subsidies? Why did President Goodluck Jonathan do this, do you think?
Okay. As I said, my name is Anide Akuru from Africa Faith and Justice Network in Washington.
Oh, I see. It's not. We have a different guest on. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead. Could you answer the question?
Yes. The situation is very unfortunate. The point is that the president tells the public that he's removing the subsidy from oil, from gas, to use for infrastructure. The point is that the estimated amount is $7 billion. That is a very paltry sum, considering the total revenue for Nigeria. That amount could easily be gotten from the political elites who are paying themselves enormous amount of money, who are wasting the country's resources on useless projects rather than make life hard for the people. Imagine this, that people were paying an equivalent of $1.70 for a gallon of gas. And then overnight, they are paying about $3.75. That is totally untenable. The government can easily take the other sources to find out how to invest in the infrastructure in the country. And by the way, for the last 10, 20 years, Nigeria has been receiving large sums of revenue from the oil. It has not invested in the infrastructure for the country.
So it is an oil-rich country, but it doesn't refine its own gasoline and has to import gasoline, which was subsidized by the government. Now they've removed these subsidies, and the people are upset. There have been riots, and there's a general strike. What's the annual income of the average Nigerian, just to get a perspective on how this is hurting them?
Okay, let me say this. Okay, let me class of people. You see, an annual income, okay, say somebody would be living, say even a school principal would be getting an equivalent of about $100 a month, okay? You get the perspective.
Sure.
So you're looking at about $3,600 a year. That is for the average worker. The average lawmaker takes home more money than President Obama earns in a year. You see the discrepancies. So if the government wanted to get resources to invest in the country, it would first have to see, explore other avenues where they are wasting money. For example, now, after the riot started, the president came up, President Jonathan Goodluck came up and said, okay, that he will slash the salaries of lawmakers by 25%. That is what he should have done first. That is what he should have explored first. And as I say, there are other avenues to come up with that $7 billion without making life harder for the people. And you indicated that the oil is refined abroad and then exported back in Nigeria. For the last 30 years, Nigeria could have built its oil refineries. And the few oil refineries that are there are not working. So it could have refined its own oil and prevent this from happening.
So in this situation, though, was Goodluck Jonathan, the president, was he pressured by the IMF to make these savings? Because, I mean, apart from the fact that it's cruel and ridiculous to take money out of poor people, and as if you want to save money, go after the rich. That's the same argument that applies here in the United States. If you need revenues,
Yes.
Is the IMF pushing this, or what's
this time around? The notion is that it is the World Bank that is pressurizing the government to do this, and I don't think there was enough consultation because the Congress, the Nigerian Congress, has voted yesterday to asking the president to rescind the decision. You know, there were negotiations going on that with the labor union that this will not take effect until April, and so overnight, in the cover of the night, on Sunday, the first of the year, somebody sneaked in and just made the announcement. So you see, there's a lot of deception going on here. And the last time there was this kind of advice from IMF about structural adjustment program, immediately they implemented that, the economy just went bust and the country has not recovered from it. So this kind of advice is only giving more avenues for the political elite to embezzle more money. The country, the international community, if they want to advise the government, should pressurize them to tackle corruption within the country first. That's the first and foremost thing. That is what is draining the economy of Nigeria, the resources, people, the politicians taking the money, buying million-dollar homes abroad, investing in other things that does not benefit the people, banking them in with fictitious names abroad. And they know who they are, they know where they are banking this money. Nigeria could easily recover $10-20 billion from these people without having to make life difficult for the poor masses.
Again, I'm speaking with Anita Akure, who is Executive Director of Africa Faith, the Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. And there is also another element, surely, in what's happening in Nigeria, and that is that this corrupt government that you're describing is also has declared a state of emergency in its conflict with the Islamic militia Boko Haram. Where does that stand?
Well, you know, this Boko Haram group has been growing up since the year 2002-2003. Unfortunately, the government didn't tackle it head on. And it has grown to be a formidable force now, causing a serious destabilization in the country, as you have followed the news, you know, bombing Christian churches, attacking police barracks, and they claim responsibility for bombing the UN building in Abuja. And even though the government has imposed, close some boundaries and send troops into the states where most affected, that is not enough. It's a little too late. Something should have been done much earlier. And also, I have to acknowledge that this group is like, quote, an Al-Qaeda group in the sense that it is not, you can't really pinpoint it in one place. It is a very fluid group. And unfortunately, some of the elites, the political elites, who want to destabilize the present government are part and parcel of this. So if the government really wants to tackle it, it needs to go aggressively by having the state's security agents to investigate and trace and find out who are involved in this process. I think what is happening here is more than just a religious sect. Some people are disenfranchised with the situation in the country, and so it becomes a breeding avenue for recruiting young people who have no jobs, who are uneducated, who are promised false hope for the future. So they become participants in destabilizing the government. And that is what is striking me, what makes the response more... I'm flabbergasted that in the midst of that, people feeling insecure, people feeling threatened by this, the government went ahead and declared the removal of subsidies, further aggravating the situation. So he should have tackled that first and tackled the rich first before implementing whatever he thinks about the removal of the subsidy.
So, Anita Akure, does this mean, though, that the divide between the Muslim North and the Christian South is not a real one, and are the Nigerian people united in their disgust at their government, or are they divided along sectarian lines?
Well, you know, they're united against their government in many ways. In fact, for example, the strike today took place in Kano, in the extreme northern part of the country, in Abuja, in Lagos, and across the country. In terms of uniting against the government, this cuts across ethnic lines, it cuts across religious lines. The Boko Haram issue is, for me, a very different thing. It is part and parcel of a global network in some ways of the rise of Islamic sectarianism. But then, it's not all Muslims who are part of this. There are some Muslims who are actually against it. In fact, sometime last year, it started between Muslims, which they saw as progressive Muslims, versus this sectarian group. And then it spills on into the Christians becoming the target because the name Boko Haram. Boko Haram means literally Western education is sinful, it's a sin. You know, so they don't want to have any linkages with the West. And right now they see Christianity in many ways as a product of Western society. So they're attacking Christians, they're attacking institutions that they still represent this Western education. And the irony in it is that in doing so, they are using the mechanisms of the West that they are fighting against. You know, they are driving in cars to go and bomb. They are getting bombs that is, you know, made in the West and all of that. So there is a big irony in this. And although, of course, there have been suggestions even from the state security services that this group now has links to Al-Qaeda. In fact, the leader is quoted to have said, well, we are fighting for the same thing that Al-Qaeda is fighting. We and Al-Qaeda are one. So I wouldn't be surprised that this group has linked to Al-Qaeda, because the level of sophistication which they use to attack is not something that just a group of disgruntled young people can do, given the level of their illiteracy. They are not all that educated in many ways. So some other hand is still guiding what is happening here.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Anita Akure, and for filling us in on what's happening in Nigeria, and we should stay in touch.
Thank you. You have a good night.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Anita Akure, who is Executive Director of the Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about The Devil and Rick Santorum, Dilemmas of a Holy, that's H-O-L-Y, owned subsidiary.
Nothing but a dirty, dirty old man. You do your thinking with a one-track mind. Keep talking about heaven, glory, but on your face is a different story. Clean up your rap, your story's getting dusty. Wash out your mouth, your lies are getting rusty. Can't believe in nothing you say, 'cause I'm around and I see what you do.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Ferguson, who is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He is a member of the advisory board of George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems, and has an article at Altnet, The Devil and Rick Santorum, Dilemmas of a Wholly Owned Subsidiary, wholly spelt H-O-L-Y. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi there.
And I guess at this point, the wholly owned subsidiary of the Republican Party are casting about in frustration. They're unhappy with Mitt Romney and his ascendancy and the avalanche of money that is pushing him to the top of the heap. And apparently a group of Texas conservatives are meeting down at a Texas ranch, casting about for somebody else. That's Don Wildman and the Dobson and Gary Bauer, etc. Are they going to stick with what they have? They've basically got two Catholic fundamentalists, haven't they?
Look, the irony here is overwhelming. It's been written by a variety of folks that if you polled the average evangelical Protestant in the 19th century, they would sort of rank Catholics and Mormons as the lowest of the low. I mean, Mormonism they considered a cult. They didn't like Catholicism. Now, by a sort of wonderful inversion, you're exactly right. They've got two Catholics, though. To be fair, Newt Gingrich has been just about every, sort of like Freddie, his work with Freddie Mac and so forth. You know, he's been on every side of everything, including religion. That's correct. I mean, my take is support in the evangelical movement because, you know, I'm sorry to sort of say it so baldly. I hope I won't offend anyone, but a lot of these folks actually are for sale. They, I mean, you don't, I mean, wonderful Ralph Reed email, he used to be the leader of the Christian, so-called Christian Coalition that came out in the Abramoff investigation when he talked about how his real desire was to get to, I'm actually quoting now from memory, but humping that corporate dough. That's a general, that's a pretty pervasive. It doesn't affect everybody in that group, but it affects a lot of them. And Newt Gingrich in particular has made a point of funneling cash into various evangelical leaders. He put a fair amount of money just a couple of years ago into some campaign that was going on in Iowa. And I think there'll be considerable pressure to endorse Newt, even though, you know, by any standard, Newt hardly qualifies by comparison with, say, Santorum. For that stuff, but you know that's basically their business. The other thing that I noticed that I think is becoming quite extraordinary is in the now that the race has really heated up, you find. I mean, since Sheldon Adelson gave $5 million to Gingrich, they're apparently going to do a all-out promotion of a trash on Romney's Bain Capital in South Carolina. Who'd have thought that a Republican primary would feature a major documentary dumping on private equity firms? That's where you're headed here, though. I don't think I've ever seen quite anything like this. And I think before they're in, before they're finished, both God and Mammon are going to be looking at each other pretty weirdly.
Well, Tom Ferguson, you, in your alternate article, The Devil and Rick Santorum, Dilemmas of a Wholly Owned Subsidiary, H-O-L-Y, you make the case that while Republican policies are stunningly oriented towards making the richest Americans richer, the Republicans have spent decades cultivating ordinary voters to focus on social wedge issues rather than economic policies and are thus missing an opportunity in 2012 since the Democrats are vulnerable on the economy.
Yeah, look, I mean, this too is so wonderful. One hardly knows what to say. I mean, yeah, the basic problem is the Republican Party is effectively unpresentable to ordinary people on economic grounds. I mean, they're so lopsidedly weighted toward helping the super rich. And, I mean, we're not talking here even half the population. You look at the numbers in Larry Berman's book, and you find that the tax advantages and others just go so overwhelmingly to the rich that you can't really make any campaign pledges on it for very long. And Republicans, in fact, when you get them past 3 minutes of bromides on growth, they've got to change the subject. This story is quite graphically. I happened to be reading Kim Phillips Fine's book, Invisible Hands, which is an excellent discussion of how in the Goldwater campaign. They had some trouble getting any traction with the sort of free market economic stuff. And then they sort of switched to morals and race, and they did much better. Moral decay, or so they thought. And, you know, that lesson has taken wide hold. Yeah, I mean, basically, if you're a Republican candidate, most of the time in the last 30 years, you spend an enormous amount of time changing the subject from economics to foreign policy, toward some foreign threat, occasionally toward immigration, many times toward abortion, guns, racism of one form or another. I mean, the list is sort of endless. I would add that this, in a somewhat less stark form, this often characterizes conservative parties around the world. They've got a funny tendency to be identify with an established church or run generals. Anything to switch the subject. And so you come into the 2012 race with that sort of an electorate that you built over 30 years. And say, you really have to insist here that electorates are like Japanese gardens. You have to spend considerable time tending them. I mean, American voter turnout is highly variable. You can do American politicians are really good at writing rules to make it harder to vote, hard to register, repelling people, letting them know they're not welcome, especially by doing, you can even, if you control the whichever office in the state government, it's usually the Secretary of State's office that decides, for instance, voting machines, you can either put more or fewer voting machines in to a place. But, the big dodges have been, in recent years, they've been things like adding photo ID laws, which frankly are ridiculous, as a requirement to vote. You could just use your town census. Most towns in many states take census if you were really just trying to get a registration, and then also to sort of cut back on early voting. So you push down voter turnout and you try to change the subject. Then you come into 2012 with an enormous disaffected population on both the left and the right, as the Obama administration's economic policies have been such conspicuous failures. You know, they did a half-size economic stimulus. They've done nothing on mortgages. They've concentrated most of their time and effort on trying to just help banks. It's left a bitter taste in a lot of people's mouths across the political spectrum. So by all rights, the Obama folks should be very vulnerable, particularly with the persistently high unemployment still. Even that little slight downtick last month is, it's basically nothing in a span of 3 years. Anyway, so the Republicans come into this race, and you can see that most of the political establishment in the Republican Party just wants to run Romney, thinks the contrast on the economy is their ticket to heaven. And then they're sitting there with an electorate that they have coached for 30 years, and that electorate cares about economics too, but they've got a lot of other things on their mind also, and they're not inclined now to suddenly forget them. I mean, this is a bed that Republican elites made, and their problem is they've now got to lie in it.
So what about the Tom Ferguson, again, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Boston and a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, and he has an article at Alternate the Devil and Rick Santorum, Dilemmas of a Wholly Owned Subsidiary, H-O-L-Y, owned subsidiary. The economy stupid, the mantra from the Clinton days has been pretty much the way elections have gone, at least that's the assumption. We've spoken before about the vulnerability of Clinton to the Eurozone, it's worth noting that situation hasn't been solved. Sarkozy just referred to the situation in the Eurozone as very tense. So is there still a chance that they won't get their act together? They're already saying that Europe will be in recession this year, but if they really drop the ball in Europe, surely that's going to turn our economy
a single bank failure in Europe, a big one, a really big one, is likely to immediately ricochet across the Atlantic in the form of a kind of Lehman in reverse. Yeah, this, I don't think there's any doubt as to why Tim Geithner keeps going to Europe and pressing them to move as fast as they can, nor why the Federal Reserve is doing those large-scale swap agreements with the European Central Bank. I mean, that's a form of, frankly, it's a form of bank bailout. We're in another one. And again, breaking the old Badgett rule, which was, okay, in a crisis, lend freely, but at a penalty rate. We're giving the money away, just like we did to our own banks. Now, we're not doing this out of the goodness of our heart. This is about trying to prevent the American banks from being hit in a European bank failure. I don't think there's much. Yeah, if that happens, they're cooked. I probably any Republican could get elected if they have that. It's not at all clear to me that they will not, in fact, have a serious problem. And I don't myself think that the unemployment rate is going to trend straight down. I suspect it's likely to bounce back up at least once more before it does anything. Anything even better. I think Obama's going to take a very mixed record into the electorate. I think he's going to have a huge turnout problem, even under the best of circumstances. I mean, if you look at, depending on, you know, what kind of numbers you're looking at, in other words, there are some various tabulations around. I'm inclined to think that the one I sort of think is about right is probably the net nationwide trend and registrations probably running 6 or 7 points against the Democrats compared to where they were in 2008. That's counting moves toward independence as a move away from the Democrats, not necessarily to the Republicans. And I suspect you're going to see a third party, too. I mean, I have said this, I think, pretty consistently for 6 months. But if you look around the country, you can see this American Intellect group, which, as far as I can tell, is funded by folks, while they claim to be centrists, are in fact from fairly far to the right, I mean, including led by folks who have a long record of hostility, for instance, to Social Security. I think you're going to see those folks materialize in the spring.
But Tom, will they run a candidate that's going to take votes from Romney, or a candidate that's going to take votes from Obama?
I think they could run, depending on how the world develops and who they nominate. I could imagine the book. You know, Michael Bloomberg would pull a lot from Obama too, I think, if he finally decides to take the plunge. I mean, the nice thing about the American Elect scheme that has been going on around the country is none of the proposed candidates have to make any exploratory committee declarations. They can just wait and see. And in the end, you know, maybe nobody will take the plunge, or only some minor figure. There's an awful lot of stuff up in the air. I've never seen a situation, I think, in my lifetime where the population as a whole so detests the leadership of both parties. I mean, these folks are not loved by hardly anybody, not the Democrats and not the Republicans. And, you know, in that type of an environment, it's a little scary. I mean, people ask me, I just tell them, if you want to really guarantee a happy ending, see a Disney movie. We're not living in the Disney world.
So just in closing then, do you think then that this unpopular Republican, that there's any chance of the real ironic backlash that you talk about?
This is really, in short, to make a brief statement on a somewhat complicated situation. If you run most of the normal economic models of voting, which, you know, I think is to some extent a mistake. That's why, I mean, I don't think most people vote just on economics, but they include economics in the range of things they're thinking about. And so if you get a bad movement in one direction, you can change a lot of votes. But if you look at the normal models, everybody's got this thing being very, very close. I doubt that that's going to change much. You know, even if you don't go into even if you don't have a recession in Europe, and so this is, we are reversing the, you know, we're having the Democrats run so poorly on an economic run on such a poor economic record is something we haven't seen really since, what, 1979, 1980. You know, but, you know, the
we know what happened there.
Yeah,
but then they had Ronald Reagan, not Mitt Romney. I thank you for joining us, Tom Ferguson.
Okay, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Tom Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. and a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He's a member of the advisory board for George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. He's the author of The Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. And he has an article at Alternet, The Devil and Rick Santorum, Dilemmas of a Wholly, H-O-L-Y, Owned Subsidiary. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we started out talking with Michael Lind, who has an article at Salon, Race, Liberty, and Ron Paul, to talk about how Ron Paul was doing on the day before the New Hampshire primaries, where he's gaining on Mitt Romney, who seems to dominate the race and seems to be all but certain to get the nomination. Michael Lind, who's come from the South, believes that you can't discount the real kind of Dixiecrat resurgence that's down there in the South, the people that, you know, went to war, created the Civil War in this country, that they are pretty stubborn and they're going to take this race to the mat, and they just under no circumstances do they want a Mormon. And he seemed to think that even though at the end of the day he thought that Romney would probably get the nomination, because of the distribution of delegates, this would be a much longer fight than certainly that I thought it would be. I challenged him a little over his article in Salon.com, Race, Liberty, and Ron Paul, in as much as he said that Ron Paul exhibits racial idiocy in the article, which he certainly does, where he blames the Civil Rights Acts for America turning into a police state and makes a direct connection from the Civil Rights Act to the Patriot Act, which makes no sense. But I sort of pointed out that in the debate in New Hampshire, Ron Paul actually, I thought, brought up a very good point. When asked about his racism in his newsletter, he said, well, I'm the only person that condemning the war on drugs, where in America, a majority of whites take drugs, but a majority of blacks go to jail for drugs, and that's racism. And I thought that was a very welcome point that you rarely hear in the political debate or the mainstream media. But Michael suggested, I like that because I'm a progressive, so I got kind of dismissed there. We did then talk with Anita Akuru of the Africa Faith and Justice Network about what's happening in Nigeria, where the whole country's on a general strike because they took away gasoline subsidies, doubling the price of gas in a country that's a huge oil producer but yet doesn't refine any of its own gasoline. That in itself is bizarre. And I tried to find out whether, you know, Shell Oil or IMF or who's to blame. He largely fingered the problem on the incredible corruption there, how the political class just make tons of money, more than, you know, everybody makes more than the President of the United States gets in a legitimate salary. And meanwhile, the people are living on about $2 a month. So obviously they can't afford a raise in gas. And we'd also talked about the Islamist party the group of hardline Islamists, Boko Haram. And he seemed to think that they may have some political connections, sort of murky political connections with parts of the Nigerian elite, even though he also said they belong to Al-Qaeda. And then finally, Tom Ferguson joined us to talk about his article in Alternet, The Devil and Rick Santorum, The Dilemmas of a Wholly Owned Subsidiary. And he makes the point that Republican policies, while they've been stunningly oriented towards making the richest Americans richer, they've spent decades cultivating, you know, Republican voters to focus on social and wedge issues. And now that they've got a business candidate in Romney, nobody's interested in what he has to offer. And he argues that this would be the best year for a Republican business candidate to run against the Democrats because they are so vulnerable on the economy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.